It is just a little bit afternoon here on WFT. Is November 17th, 2018. Today actually marks a interesting anniversary. Today is the anniversary of a then President Richard Nixon, who in November 17th, 1973, famously said, I'll display it for you.
I want to say this to the television audience. I made my mistakes, but in all of my years of public life, I have never profited from public service. I've earned every cent. And in all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. And I think, too, that I can say that in my years of public life, that I welcome this kind of examination, because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
President?
Yes, sir.
And, of course, that was eventually Richard Nixon would eventually go on to resign after the Watergate scandal. After the Watergate eventually played out, and I believe it was about a year later, so 1974. It took a couple of years, and so Richard Nixon eventually resigned. Then Vice President Ford eventually pardoned him. So yeah, that didn't exactly go out too well. Well, and now of course we. Kind of interesting now with our current president, who has been tweeting about how with the Mueller investigation. He tweeted just a few days ago, the White House is running. This was November 15th. President Donald Trump tweeted, "The White House is running very smoothly, and the results of our nation are obviously very good. We are the envy of the world. But anytime I even think about making changes." The fake news media goes crazy, always seeking to make us look as bad as possible. Very dishonest. Followed by another tweet: "The inner workings of the Mueller investigation are a total mess. They have found no collusion and have gone absolutely nuts. They are screaming and shouting at people, horribly threatening them to come up with the answers they want. They are a disgrace to our nation and don't quote." ... followed by another tweet: "Don't care how many lives they ruined. These are angry people, including the highly conflicted Bob Mueller, who worked for Obama for 8 years. They won't even look at all the bad acts and crimes on the other side. A total witch hunt like no other in American history." And yeah, so it's I'll read two more. This is again November 15th. President Trump's Twitter: "Universities will someday study what highly conflicted and not Senate approved Bob Mueller and his gang of Democrat thugs have done to destroy people. Why is he protecting Crooked Hillary, Comey, McCabe, who I believe was the former FBI director?" Lisa Page and her lover, Peter S., and all of his friends on the other side. And the only collusion is that of the Democrats with Russia and many others. Why didn't the FBI take the server from the DNC? They still don't have it. Check out how biased Facebook, Google, and Twitter are in favor of the Democrats. That's the real collusion." So I'll just say this. Mark Twain once said, "History is like poetry. It doesn't exactly repeat itself, but it does rhyme," or something like that. But I do have a guest with me. His name is Ben Chapman, who ran for county commissioner. County board. Amen. I think that's the right way. I'm both, just in case. I'm here with Ben Chapman, who ran for county board, District 1. Did not win, unfortunately, but, he's, 21?
Yeah, I'm 21. Yeah. Thanks for having me today.
Sure. It's, Do you, I don't know if you want to kind of talk about like that whole experience and how what that, you know, maybe what you learned, because
yeah. So I started out my sort of adventure in politics back in I want to say August or September of 2017. So this was in the primary, and I was I got my start volunteering with John Ebel's congressional campaign. He was a friend of mine, and I knew he was a great guy, and I had high hopes for what he could be as a congressman. So that was where I kind of learned the process. And one phrase or mantra that kept coming up time and time and time again from these sort of experienced politicians that I really looked up to was, this isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. And that was kind of what got me through my entire campaign, and what I think allowed me to sort of, even though I lose with a level of dignity, and do well by the people who watched my campaign and who volunteered for my campaign. And what that means, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. That means that there's no single day, there's no single moment that's going to make or break a candidacy, going to make or break a campaign, going to make or break an election year. There's no single moment, as much as sometimes, you know, pundits or lobbyists may like to say that there is. Really, it's a long process of you know, somebody being on the public stage for a long period of time, seeing if they can stand up to the criticism, seeing if they can stand up to the tough questions, and sometimes the vitriol that comes at them from all angles. And it's campaigning is about what I learned is it's about an attitude. It's about being clear that you can be in the public's eye, and you can be something that people can be proud of, and they can trust you that you'll represent them well. So those are the biggest things I learned, especially in those final days of the campaign, where you just want to go all out and kind of give every last bit of what you have to the campaign. But you have to remind yourself that you've been running this marathon for the past 6 months to a year, to a year and a half. And that if you start sprinting now and start making mistakes, you begin to run the risk of compromising the work you did to get to that point. So I guess that was one of the biggest things I learned, is that it really is just proving, you have to prove yourself time and time again, that you are a person of quality, and that you deserve to represent people in office.
And I think, you know, since, as you've already stated, but you're 21 years old, I mean, we have seen a lot of, I think, young people, definitely a lot of, you know, the millennials or Generation Z being more involved, I think, definitely more, since, you know, even on the national kind of, you know, Congress, mm-hmm. somebody, I believe the average age of Congress, it will, you know, when this new Congress gets, when they start, they'll be like a decade younger than the current Congress is. So I think, but I think even locally, we've seen a more more young people paying attention to what's going on, both at the local, state, and the and of course national level. And that's, you know, obviously for, and that's obviously a good thing, you know, for young people to pay attention to, you know, what's going on. You know, because what happens at the local level affects you just as much, if not more, than what happens at the national level. And I've been kind of bringing this up, an example with the U.S. census. I believe that's coming up in a couple of years, or 2020. When that kind of affects, district, redistricting, and now with the county executive, that position, and, you know, with the current, and with the county commission, how do we district, how will our voting, how will our district look, will be obviously very important, and that will be a decision that they, they'll have to make. When that time comes, but And kind of speaking on since on the subject of voting, you are very kind of passionate about this. And that, this was something I think you brought up, I think, when you were running for state senate back in the ranked choice voting, and something just recently happened in the state of Maine about ranked choice voting. So if you want to talk about
that. Yeah, absolutely. So it has been a kind of a large part of my campaign, both when I was attempting to get on the ballot for state senate and when I was running for county board in the general election, is talking about ranked choice voting and talking about ways that we can make our elections more inclusive. And that means both making sure that, that polling places are available to everyone, but also making sure that the ballot is designed in a way that works for people, regardless of whether they belong to one of the major two parties or not. And this requires a bit of explaining, because not everybody understands what ranked choice voting is. And I'll be honest, it's a bit difficult to explain over, you know, just plain speech. It's very simple through video or even instinctually, once you have a decent grasp of some of the mechanisms behind runoff voting and other such methods. But I'll do my best. So basically, ranked choice voting is when you go into a ballot booth, currently you can only pick one candidate. You see a list of, you know, three or four candidates, and you pick only one. Ranked choice voting says, you know what, rank them in order of your favorites. That's all the voter has to do. It's not complex. And if you don't want to rank any, if you just want to pick one, you're free to do that. That's your choice. But if you are a very educated voter with a very in-depth opinion on the candidates, you'll rank, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, going down the list, in order of your preference. What happens then is the votes are counted in rounds. So first, the first place votes are counted. So you'll tally up all the first place choices. If no candidate has over 50% of those first place votes, which isn't in every case, many times candidates do win, you know, the majority of those first place votes, in which case the election proceeds as any normal election would. But if no candidate does receive over 50%, then the second place choices are counted from those first place choices that didn't go to a person with the plurality. So in a bit more understandable language, the lowest vote getter of the first round is eliminated. Their votes are then split up or transferred to the second choices of those voters who previously voted for that last place voter. And that sort of round structure continues on until the votes are transferred in such a way that one candidate has over 50% of the votes. Now, we go to Maine. We'll take a step back first. Why does this help? And I explain this in two different ways, depending on who I'm talking to. The first way is if I'm talking to somebody who paid very close attention to this election, the 2000 election, I believe it was, Al Gore versus George Bush. There is some serious frustration still that Ralph Nader, it was Ralph Nader, yes, who split off votes from Mr. Gore or Vice President Gore, and people still haven't really given Ralph Nader or forgiven Ralph Nader for taking those votes away. Those were votes that they considered to be left-leaning and votes that otherwise would have gone to Vice President Gore. And to me, that is a sign of an unhealthy democracy when you're blaming a candidate for saying what they believe in and getting votes, and you're somehow putting them at fault. So what ranked choice voting does is those people who would have voted for Ralph Nader, they can still vote for him as their first choice. But when he is the lowest vote getter out of that first round, those votes are then transferred on to the second choices of those candidates. And not all of those votes are going to go to Vice President Gore. But since those votes were substantially left-leaning or from left-leaning folks, their second choices are most likely to be the vice president. So that in that situation, ranked choice voting could have altered the outcome of a presidential election and altered the outcome of know, who was governing the United States for 8 years. So this does matter. And I look forward, I also look at the 2016 primary on the Republican side as an example of where ranked choice voting was help as well. We had, I think at one point, you know, over 14 candidates in the race. Not all of them were extremely serious on the Republican side, but some of them, you know, there were some heavy hitters in there. And when you have that huge amount of candidates, voters tend to gravitate towards the person who sticks out. And we had one person who really stood out in that primary. And that person didn't get a lot of votes at first. They were kind of seen as crazy, and they still should be seen as kind of crazy. but eventually, when you have that many candidates, the voters and the supporters of that candidate kind of group together. They become loud, and that person sort of had a base of voters who were pretty far right. And so even though Mr. Trump, when he was a candidate at the time, even though he didn't have majority support at, I don't think, any point in the primary until a lot of the candidates had dropped out, even though he didn't have majority support, he, just by being the one candidate who was different and way out there, managed to get just a small number of votes, and the other sort of mainstream candidates had to split all their votes up. Now, if ranked choice voting was in place, those sort of more mild, more moderate, more reasonable Republican voters would have been able to say, okay, I like Marco Rubio the most. I like Chris Christie second most. I like Ted Cruz third most, even though Ted Cruz is somewhat far right as well, if I'm being honest. But there would have been much less splitting up of those rational voters. And I'm not sure the Trump presidency campaign would ever have gotten off the, you know, off the ground. But because of the electoral system, those votes split so much, and now we have a President Trump. Hmm. So yeah, Maine, right?
Yeah.
All right.
I believe that was, if I can bring that up as I.
Yeah.
Election official? Yeah, to declare Democrat. The Democrat in Maine, Jared Colden, would be the first member of Congress elected by ranked choice voting, and they're hoping to also adapt this in New Hampshire for their presidential primary. And so, yeah, as you said, or in according to this article in USA Today, under Maine's system, voters can rank their choices among the candidates on the ballot first, second, third, etc. First choices are then tallied. If no candidate gets 50% or more, the bottom candidate is dropped, and there's the second choice of those voters gets added to the tallies of the remaining candidates. Excuse me. If there are still no candidates with 50% or more, then the procedure is repeated until there is a candidate who has the support of at least 50% of the voters. So essentially, basically, you know, I mean, and wouldn't you agree that this is kind of is a way to deal with the two-party system, a way to kind of, you know, people that complain about that say, well, you can basically, you know, it's not just, oh, you have to vote for one or the other. It's, well, you have all these candidates, you know, especially during the primary, you have all these candidates and you just rank, yeah, you essentially vote for whichever one that the one that appeals to you most, and then from, you know, most favorite to least, and then basically whoever has the most votes, how the way they tally it, kind of. I think in certain cases, is there like a runoff or like a special election or like a runoff?
Yeah, so ranked choice voting is called instant runoff voting. There are states and many municipalities that use runoff voting currently.
Georgia uses it. Yeah, did that.
Whether they should or not is a really good question. From a democracy point of view, it makes perfect sense. Mm. From a budgeting and logical point of view, to me, it makes very little sense. They should really just switch to instant runoff voting or ranked choice voting. They're two names for essentially the same thing. But yeah, they're wasting a lot of taxpayer mm-hmm. money and a lot of time on having these runoff elections. Mm.
With what's going on in Florida, you know, kind of bring up Florida again, you know, it seems like now with the whole recounting kind of process, it looks like DeSantis will win mm-hmm. That race after the whole, but it seems like Florida and Georgia, it seems like there's a lot of speculation with all, you know, with what's happening, especially in Georgia, with all the reports of voting, just a lot of voter suppression or just stories of these voting machines that were just left, and just, you know, it just doesn't seem like it was done fairly democratically, I guess. It just,
right.
It was just very, and of course, with in Georgia, the Secretary Kemp, who is the Secretary of State, essentially, people say it was kind of like he was both the candidate and the referee. So, and it just felt like there were a lot of just issues with that, and it just doesn't seem like it was done very, very anti-democratically, really.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people, I mean, share that. I share that yeah. same frustration. And when these things continue to happen, I mean, people lose faith in their democracy. Yeah. And right now, I mean, you can look at these news reports across the country and see this frustration, see that there are people who really don't like the system. But when you go to Maine, especially Maine's second congressional district, mm. there's honestly quite a bit of enthusiasm around mm. how well their system's working. And I can give you some background to this. This, I guess it was a federal case with Congressman Poliquin. I honestly am not entirely sure on the pronunciation of his name because I've only read it. But it was Poliquin versus Jared Golden, the Democratic challenger. So, and it's so important to look at this because it's a situation where everything worked perfectly. And I, as an advocate for ranked choice voting, saw this happen and saw that ranked choice voting leapt onto the national stage. And it just did so in such a beautiful way and in the quintessentially perfect scenario for demonstrating its benefits. So what happened is Golden, the Democrat, was behind after the initial count of votes. Maine uses ranked choice voting for all elections, congressional, U.S. federal elections, and state level elections. And they'd gone through some court challenges at the state level because Maine is quite an interesting state politically. We'll say that. And they have a lot of independence there. And that's the reason why they've adopted ranked choice voting in the first place. But essentially, we had this situation where the plurality of votes went to Congressman Poliquin, the Republican. And those were the first ranked votes. And after that, it initially seemed like Poliquin was going to win. He had a solid, I think it was a couple percentage points maybe over Golden. And then the second choice votes started counting, and 8% of voters didn't vote for Poliquin or Golden, and they went on to cast their second choices. Now, those second choices went to Golden. So even though those first place votes went to mostly or in a plurality form to Poliquin, the second place votes came in from independents who were eliminated and went to Golden, and Golden ended up winning by about a percentage point. So as you can imagine, Poliquin is somewhat disappointed to be the first candidate defeated by an actually democratic system, and he files a lawsuit. This isn't uncommon, to be fair. candidates oftentimes, you know, they reach the end of their campaign and it's a long campaign season, and they want to do everything they can, and they should do everything they can to make sure that everything happened fairly and justly, because, you know, they have lots of volunteers, they have lots of supporters, and they have to do what's right to make sure that those supporters are heard and that the election proceeds justly. But what Poliquin did was he basically filed a lawsuit, and he threw a handful of darts roughly in the vicinity of a dartboard and prayed that one of them would hit the bullseye, and none of them even came close. So he alleged two things primarily. Let me see if I can find. So the first one was a 14th Amendment claim. He was claiming that those voters who chose a first place candidate, who ranked the first choice on their ballot, but didn't rank any further, he claimed that they were not being equally protected by law as those voters who voted, you know, for 1, 2, 3, and 4. Basically, he was saying that those votes are not being counted, that those people who didn't rank another, you know, a following 2, 3, 4 slate, he was saying they weren't being heard, and that was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And the judge basically said, you know, they had the opportunity. That's like saying, you know, you could have gone to, you know, two equally funded people could go to a university, and because one of them doesn't choose to, that's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. They're not being protected equally. It's ridiculous. And the judge basically said so. He said, this has no basis. In fact, he actually pointed out there's some irony to this, to the equal protection claim. He said, Poliquin is basically saying that since some people are not being heard, we should instead change the electoral system to actually eliminate all these 2, 3, and 4 choices and just go back to the plurality system, even though people felt that they were expressing themselves under a ranked choice system. So the claim Poliquin was putting forth actually would have been more detrimental to the protection of voters' rights and expression than the alternative. And the second thing he said was very similar, was the First Amendment. People are not being heard by ranked choice voting, and that's a violation of their rights as citizens under the First Amendment. And again, the judge said none of this sticks. I mean, it had held up under Maine's courts, and now it was seeing federal court and ranked choice voting as it almost always finds itself in a court battle, but it almost always gets through. And the reason it always winds up in a court battle is, for two reasons. One, there's sore losers who lose under the system and they want to fight it, and they should. It's their right to do that. But two, it's because there are so many misunderstandings about ranked choice voting and how it works. There are folks out there who argue that when you have that ranking 1, 2, 3, 4 on, that that's actually having more than one vote. When in reality, the system is actually just allowing you to transfer your vote from one candidate to another. So we have in America for a long time going back this idea of one person, one vote. And even though that's sort of an arbitrary principle that I would love to see changed, and actually Fargo, a city, has stepped away from that principle. They're one of the first cities to do that, but that's another story for another time. Ranked choice voting essentially is not a step away from the one person, one vote. It's just one person and one more accurate vote, one more more heartfelt vote. So that's why it keeps winning in courts.
And do you see, what do you hope for, do you see in terms of, or hope that this will be kind of law or the norm for other states? Like here in Illinois, we don't have it, but it's something. I know he was then the candidate, but J.B. Pritzker has been who's now, the governor, our governor-elect, been wanting to, or he was supposed to come here and talk about it, I think.
Eventually ended up somewhat opposing it in sort of a weird way. He he said we don't have enough information on ranked choice voting, and that that I believe he said, and there's a statement that can be found from the Illinoisans for Ranked Choice Voting, the group that I'm part of. Mr. Prisker basically said he didn't feel there was enough information. He didn't feel like it had gone under enough tests, and that he was still open to anything that expanded our democracy. I'm uncertain why he feels there isn't enough information. I can find, you know, decades worth, even a century's worth of information on how well ranked choice voting works, because other places, Australia and New Zealand and Ireland, not to mention many municipalities across America, have been using ranked choice voting for a long time. And honest to God, every single activist I talk to says, yeah, this works great. This works wonderfully. And it makes our politicians more honest. I was out in San Francisco and during the primary, and what happened there was quite something. San Francisco previously used runoff voting, where they'd have an election under the current system, but if, you know, one candidate got 48% of the vote and one candidate got 46%, and an independent got the middle of those votes, I guess it would be like 6%, then they'd run another election taking out that independent candidate and seeing how those two kind of first and second place candidates fared directly against each other. So that's a long route towards getting at what ranked choice voting actually accomplishes. So then, you know, San Francisco saw logically that what they were doing was a waste of time, a waste of money, and they transformed their election system to a ranked choice voting system, which is now speedier. But what happens with ranked choice voting is there are sort of coalitions made. You get, instead of mudslinging and instead of vitriol, you actually have candidates that team up. And it's amazing because it's so unheard of in our politics today. And it's actually our current system pushes against coalition building. And I say that because if you look at a crowded primary, maybe where there's four kind of moderate candidates and one candidate who's kind of out there. And let's say you have an electorate that is primarily moderate, but there are some out there voters. Those moderate candidates are going to have a very difficult time finding ways that they're different. They have to stand out. You can't win an election with a crowded field if you don't stand out. Mm. That's the bottom line, because you have to show people why you are better than all the other candidates. So even if you largely agree with many other candidates, you have to, in some way, find a way to artificially separate yourself. And that's what results in these negative ads. That's what results in these attacks and the anger we see in our politics. It's not the only thing that results in that, but it's what results in, it catalyzes it, and it makes it worse, because candidates are disagreeing and they're running negative ads where they otherwise wouldn't be. And in San Francisco, we actually had two progressive candidates who both opposed or both were frustrated with the sort of mainstream establishment candidate that was put forth. And they actually ended up kind of combining forces. They shared literature, they shared mailers, they shared campaign events. And they said, hey, we're both running against each other, against in quotes, but we agree. And we both, either one of us will be better than this establishment candidate. And so two candidates who under our current system would have to artificially make themselves sworn enemies could campaign together. They could say they have the same ideas. They could campaign efficiently. Even though they were underfunded, they could get their message out better. Now, neither of them ended up winning, but they did far better, and they perhaps wouldn't have even had candidacies, or one of them would have been forced to drop out and endorse the other in order for either of them to have a choice. So ranked choice voting allows candidates a better field to run in, and it allows more coalition building, it allows more friendships to be made, and it allows voters to respect that, to respect when a candidate is civil and kind and and friendly to other people, which is it's sad that we're sort of missing some of that today.
And I think, you know, as you kind of state, the Mr. Polican or the Republican who lost and is challenging the results, you in Georgia, Stacey Abrams, who she has conceded that, you know, she lost, but she is still filing a lawsuit with the way, you know, this is different, obviously, because as you said, she's filing a federal suit against Georgia for gross mismanagement of the vote. So she's still not, so it's different in that she's basically saying, look, I lost. But the way this was handled was incredibly, quoted, gross mismanagement, because of all the reports of reports of voter suppression. And she's basically saying, look, we need to make sure that this doesn't happen again, because democracy is at stake. And whereas, I'm not even sure, has Polican even conceded yet, or is he?
I believe he's still carrying out the suit, but I want to say he's conceded.
Yeah,
the vote count is done, he's lost the race. Okay. But it's the same situation with, I believe it's Representative Abrams. I'm not sure what her current position is, but Representative Abrams hasn't officially conceded, because what she's saying is this was done wrong, and I would concede if I had lost an election fair and square. Mm-hmm. A concession is a statement that my opponent has won fair and square and that this was done properly. But Representative Abrams is saying, I didn't see any I didn't see the fairness in this. So
I'm not exactly sure how recent it is, but maybe she But yeah, she's definitely, I know, filing a lawsuit against Georgia about how the election was carried out.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so it'll be interesting to see how that carries out.
Right. And I think looking at these candidates, it's sometimes tough, because we see Congressman O'Rourke, I believe he's a congressman.
Representative in the area of El Paso is kind of like his.
A very charismatic candidate that had a lot of love from all across the country. We see Andrew Gillum, we see Stacey Abrams, all these people that were absolutely loved, and each one of them unfortunately came up short. And it's sad, and it's disheartening to see that. As I mean, I'm a Democrat, so it's sad for me when Democrats lose. But it's sad because we had so much love for them, and we had so much anticipation for the new voices they would bring. But we also have to remember that many of these candidates, I mean, I'm sure that Mr. O'Rourke and Ms. Abrams didn't have any huge expectation that they would win. But what they did believe was that running and saying what they believed in was valuable. They believed that they could make people feel heard again. And when people feel heard, they turn out and vote. They actually start to care about their community. They start to have these conversations. So conversations that may have not been happening in Texas, or may not have not been happening in Georgia, are now happening. And people are seeing women like Stacey Abrams and men like Andrew Gillum, who look like them, are you know, in the highest levels of debate and are being inspired. And that's a huge thing. It's a huge thing to happen for states where sometimes it doesn't happen. So it's easy to be sad about it. It's easy to say, it was all for nothing. But I think we're going to see in the coming years that, so many people have been inspired by what happened in this 2018 midterms. And we're going to see a new sort of political awakening, where people are really invested in what's happening.
Well, I mean, essentially, that's kind of how politics, you know, in America has always been. Even Abraham Lincoln didn't win the Senate election against Stephen Douglas. I'm a little bit knowledgeable in that, considering I'm from a town called Alton, and that was one of the locations of one of the many debates between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas. Of course, everyone knows that, you know, even though Lincoln lost, he got so much. And this, some people, I've seen a few comparisons with this with Beto O'Rourke, that, you know, with Lincoln, he got so much publicity, and people were so, you know, amazed by, you know, him in these debates that he had with Douglas, that, you know, eventually he just, I guess, I'm not exactly, it was 18, I mean, well, somewhere around 1860. I'm trying to think of the election that election then, that, yeah, he eventually, even though he lost, he eventually got so much publicity and so much notoriety, notorious from those debates, that he eventually was elected president. So, you know, politics, it just, because, you know, as James Joyce once said, sometimes or failures or mistakes can obviously lead to other things, or maybe said discovery, but yeah, just because, you're not, don't let one loss define you. You know, you're always, you can be, as you said, learn, you learn from that experience, and then, eventually, if you give another shot, you can perhaps win. In fact, I think Barack Obama, when he ran for state senate, or when he, one of the first times he did run, I don't think he didn't win, state senate, I want to say, he didn't win the first, one of the first times, I think.
Yeah, but you want a bit of trivia, actually, yeah. President Barack Obama, when he was a state senator, actually introduced a ranked choice voting bill. He was one of the two people in Illinois state legislature history to introduce a bill regarding ranked choice voting. The other one is State Senator Daniel Biss. So there are heavy hitters on this issue. But anyway, that's off the topic. The topic of losing, I mean, I lost my recent election, so I appreciate you saying that. I do agree. It's incredibly valuable to say what you believe in, and not just from the inspirational side of things, but also from, Betsy Dirksen Londrigan ran a very fine campaign in the Illinois 13th,
she ran for representative.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Representative here in the 13th district. Yeah.
Yeah, which we're in. One of the more liberal areas of as we sit here now, and I was a huge supporter of hers, and I mean I was supporting John Ebel in the primary, but I think one of the big reasons that Betsy ran such a strong campaign, one that had never really been matched previously, just in terms of feet on the ground and total dollars spent, was because the primary was kind of crowded.
There was like a long list of, like, I couldn't even name all,
All. We had John Ebel, we had David Gill, we had Dr. David Gill, Angel Sides was one, and Mr. Eric Jones. So each of those campaigns, none of them was particularly weak. Each one of them brought a sort of unique set of resources to the stage. And because the Illinois 13th primary was so civil, all these resources ended up going towards Betsy, who eventually won the primary. And I call her Betsy because we kind of know each other. Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's more proper to refer to her as Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, I realize. But essentially, those resources from the losing candidates went to Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan's campaign and turned it into something amazing. I mean, I can't count the number of interns and volunteers I met on John Ebel's campaign that eventually went on to work on the Dirksen-Londrigan campaign. And because of their work previously in the primary, they were decently experienced. Even I am sort of an example of that. I may not have been so involved in politics if I hadn't been inspired and taught how to run a campaign by sitting at, you know, a dinner table with John Ebel and his little merry band as we tried to figure out what the best way was to represent our ideas to the Democratic voters in IL-13. So there is so much to be said for running and losing. It's both uplifting to see somebody who believes in what you say, or who believes in what you believe, and says what needs to be said, but it also has very real effects of teaching people how to campaign, teaching people, getting people connected, getting people in action, and transforming a community into one that's involved in itself. It's important to run even if you lose, for sure.
We got roughly 10 minutes, but I got a few things I just need to make clear. Of course, the views and opinions expressed on there are solely those of the speaker, do not necessarily represent those of WFT, Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And just some, I won't say these, but if you want to look at what the art theater showing, we always talk about what's showing at the art theater, but I want to kind of save some little bit of time, but if you want to look up what's playing at the art theater, they play some really good, interesting movies, some movies you're not going to see like at the regular movie theater, what's always at the box office. But if you want to go see what's playing, just one of the movies they're playing is Velvet Goldmine and Can You Ever Forgive Me? And of course, for all up-to-date times, you can go to the Art Theater's website, www.theartheater.org. And we here at WEFT were recently informed of an issue. Well, probably not recently. It's been a little bit, some time has passed since. But to stay on the air, we had an issue with our broadcast tower. And to stay on the air, we were making plans to relocate our antenna and transmitter in the next few months. This is going to cost about $50,000, which is, of course, an unanticipated expense for the kind of station we have, which is we're all volunteers, and this expense is kind of essentially approaches our annual budget. So if you're interested in helping to keep this community treasure operational, you can do so in several different ways. You could join WEFT as an individual member at WFT.org. If you have a business, you could become an underwriter for WEFT programming. And if you know of possible grants or other types of funding, you can share that information with us or even partner with WFT on your next at your next fundraiser. And because WFT can provide people power and free promotion. And of course, for more information, you can send an email to station manager, that's all one word, so station manager, no space, @ weft.org. And of course, you can stream us online, just a reminder, at weft.org. That's where a lot of our shows get archived. I think you have to go to click on the shows tab. That's where my show, The World We Live In, hopefully you know the name by now. I've been on air for almost 9 months, about 9 months. So it's so coming up to a year, but not exactly. But I don't know if Mr. Chapman, if you had anything else. You were kind of interested if hopefully we could talk a little bit about what's going on in California, because I know you were actually just there with in San Francisco, which by the terrible forest fires, and I don't know how many people have unfortunately been killed, but it's really just a tragic situation.
Yeah. First off, I'd love to say, I mean, I love coming on the show and I love this station. So if you're able to donate, I mean, I'm a broke college student and I definitely would, but please do, because they do great work, and local media and good local media is hugely important. So, please do whatever you can. And yeah, I wasn't recently out there, but I have family out there who just flew in actually for Thanksgiving. So they may actually be listening to this right now. But yeah, I want to talk about the forest fires. I'm a writer, and I like to write about current issues. And I'm writing a piece right now on this topic. And one of the frustrations that led me to write about it was, well, the president felt the need to express his thoughts on it. And his thoughts were just so wildly, wildly off by every measure. To begin with, he sort of said, hey, fix this problem or we'll remove your funding. And that's sort of a strange solution coming from a president. But he said this while there were casualties, there were deaths. What's happening is horrible by every measure. And it's devastating. I think the casualties are between 60 and 70 deaths so far. There are hundreds and hundreds of people who haven't been found. Tens of thousands, if not nearly 100,000 people evacuated so far, and countless structures destroyed. So people's lives are never going to be the same. But beyond that, I mean, my siblings who just flew in from San Francisco, they were saying the air was really tough to breathe. So even if people haven't evacuated, even if they haven't been directly affected, there are awful, awful, awful effects happening just if you're around the area. It's a truly horrible thing, and the president had no tact in addressing it. And I don't want to make it seem like I'm politicizing this issue, but it is political, just for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is California has a very known reputation for being a progressive state, and when things go wrong there, sometimes the gut reaction of some folks is to criticize California. And governors and former governors of California have been in feuds with the president over a number of issues, sanctuary cities, taxes, what a tax system should look like, and environmental regulations. California has pretty strict air quality regulations. But this issue and the fact that the president implicitly blamed California's mismanagement of the forest fires and of wildlands was just so off base that it struck me. And one of the reasons I think we have to point out is managing land is very difficult. It's incredibly, incredibly difficult. Part of that is our fault as humans, that we make it so difficult, but part of it is because land really doesn't want to be managed. We need fire. Fire is necessary to help giant sequoias and jack pines repopulate an area. It's necessary to keep invasive species out of an area. It's necessary to provide a wonderful sort of a fertilizer. Wood ash is actually a great fertilizer and can provide very important nutrients to plants. And I should say this, I'm saying all this as somebody who's done research to write about it. I'm not an expert on the topic at all. So take everything I say with a grain of salt.
More than I know. So,
well, yeah. So fire is important, and it used to be that we could rely on natural fire to keep our system to keep our ecosystems in line. But more and more, we have to rely on prescribed fire. And when you look at California, and when you look at who manages the wildlands and those areas that are now a substantial portion of them are in flames. I think 60%, no, I know 60% of the forest lands, or 57% of forest lands, are managed by the federal government in California. That's the Department of Interior and the U.S. Forest Service, both of which are executive agencies, which are under the president, actually. So it's an executive branch's failure. It's an executive branch's failure to manage that properly. The rest are It's about, it's almost all of the rest of that land is privately managed, and a very small portion of it is actually managed by California. Now, that's not to say that California and California's policies and California's progressive air quality restrictions or regulations don't come into play. They do, and they make some management that could prevent fires difficult. But California is not at fault for the things they are suffering right now, and the fact that the president has decided to blame them for it is disgusting. So that's what I wanted to say on that topic.
Well, and essentially, it's almost, you know, it's you're blaming the victim while, you know, while this horrific, you know, event is occurring. So yeah. You're definitely not helping. And, you know, when you're the leader of, you know, when you are the leader of the United States, you're the leader of the free world, you're the commander in chief. If, you know, what people look for is leadership and, you know, just some kind of responsibility of, and that just
right.
Didn't happen.
It's worth noting that some of this destruction is worsened because of climate change, which our president still fails to acknowledge as a reality and definitely still fails to act on. So, I mean, the president is partly at fault for what's happening, and yet he's decided to pass on the blame to some other folks.
Yeah, and so I guess it'll be, you know, interesting to kind of see, you know, now that the midterms are over, what's going to happen with, you know, the Democrats taking the House, how will that happen? And of course, you know, like as I said, you know, on the local level, I'm sure there'll be some elections coming up in 2019, and so, you know, and so and I just would like to thank, you know, as I end the show here, as we come up at the end of the hour, thank you, Mr. Chapman, for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sorry about you not winning your election, but hey, you're only 21, so you can run again for any other thing, and please feel free to come on my show again. And,
thank you very much.
Yeah, and talk well, about it. All right. Well, that'll be basically it for my show. I'm on the subject of running for office, and I'm going to play Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good rest of your day. And, of course, stay tuned for more programming here at WEFT Champaign. Thanks again. Enjoy have a good day. Saturday. Oh, and, of course, happy Thanksgiving. That's coming up Thursday.
Sorry about that. We had a momentary technical glitch. We'll be right back with you here at WEFT Champaign.